Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Cathedral Podcast. And I'm very glad to have with me Professor Gordon T. Smith, speaking to me all the way from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Hi, Gordon.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thank you so much for staying back late in your office to talk with me after a really long day yourself. You are Professor of Systematic and Spiritual Theology at the Ambrose University. And I got your connection through, of course, many Singaporeans have been to Regent College in Vancouver. And of course, you are also a teaching fellow there. And you have written many, many books. And I'm going to be discussing a little bit on one of them with you. But I'm excited to just highlight that just last year, in the midst of everything the world is going through, you wrote a book with a very interesting title. It says, Wisdom from Babylon, Leadership for the Church in a Secular Age. So maybe just some brief comments about how you are and a little bit about this book to start us off.
Sure. Happy to speak briefly about it because I know that you want to focus on something else. But for a number of years, I've been asking, what does it mean to be the church in a society that has become increasingly secular? Mm-hmm. And I think the overall disposition of evangelicals, at least here in North America and in Canada, has been to establish kind of an adversarial relationship to secularity, that this is a bad thing, that religion is better, that the more secular we become, the greater the threat to the church. Mm. And I wanted to make the case that perhaps secularity is not a bad thing, but is actually a new opportunity for what it means to be the church. And rather than be in an adversarial relationship, that we would actually look at it as an opportunity for the church to flourish. Mm-hmm. So I use the text, and that's the wisdom from Babylon. I use the text of Jeremiah 29 to seek the peace of the city to which we have been sent. We pray for it. We plant gardens. We give ourselves to the city and to its well-being. And rather than an adversarial relationship, look at the opportunities for the church to fulfill its identity and its mission in that way. So, and it's interesting, I try to insist that I'm not speaking for other parts of the world, but only for North America. But what I have found is that many Christians in Hong Kong and Singapore and many other parts of the world, Romania, for example, have said, no, this is helpful in our context as well, in terms of how we navigate this kind of a world. And then in that context to say, well, what then does it mean to be the church when we are a minority presence? And Christians in North America are used to being the majority. They're used to being in control, politically influential. We elect our kind of people, and the laws reflect our laws. So what does it mean to be a minority presence is something that the church in North America, at least, is just beginning to learn.
Yeah, so good. I think, I can really resonate with that because I think secularism is like the new religion in a post-Christian, post-truth era. And certainly, especially all the urban centers in the world can clearly relate to this.
Right.
Yeah, so that's going to be an interesting book. And so that deserves another conversation, probably. You know, I learned that all truth is God's truth, and that is something that we can always learn. And really at the heart of what you said about that adversarial position, that is worth unpacking. How did we come to adopt that stance, right? What is the theology and the historical antecedent that led us to this place? And of course, it was okay at a time when we were the majority, of course, because you kind of get to define things. But now that you're in a minority position, you find yourself back to a corner. And then you kind of like,
But important, Jenny, to say the church has always flourished as a minority, whether it's Japan or whether it's China or India or Lebanon or Pakistan or Turkey. The church has flourished as a in Egypt. The church has flourished over centuries as a minority presence. So it can be done, but we just need to sometimes learn how to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So back to our subject for today, we are actually here to speak about disagreement. And I didn't want to disagree with you about your book. No, I wasn't going to. I'm just teasing you. And I think that's a very important topic. I mean, you know, what we just talked about, the whole rising secularism. And of course, we know historically the church has had many doctrinal distinctives, you know. And it's, you know, interesting when we look back at Jesus's last words and his final great high priestly prayer in John chapter 17, for us to be one, for us to be united. And as Christians, we love that Psalm 133, speaking of, you know, how blessed it is when brothers dwell in unity. And then, you know, we have this, the actual prayer of Jesus himself, the psalm, you know, the poetry and the cry of the human heart. And then at the same time, this reality presented to us, which is, okay, we are a pretty divided lot of people. How can we understand this in a way that is helpful? Because it's so easy to be discouraged. It's so easy to, you know, be cynical. Yeah. So how can we understand that prayer and that psalm in the light of what, of so-called reality as we witness it?
No, I appreciate very much the way you have framed the question, because I do think the call to unity, the call to live in harmony with our sisters and brothers, as you put it in Psalm 33, is an ideal that we need to strive for and work for. But it is very important that we learn how to define what we mean by that unity. Mm. I think all too frequently, we assume that unity is uniformity, that unity is compliance, that unity means we agree on everything. And that if you disagree with me, then I cannot be in fellowship with you. Mm. And I'm going to refer very early on to Romans chapter 14, where clearly the believers in Rome disagreed profoundly with each other on some very important matters. But yeah. Paul says to them in Romans 15:7, welcome one another in the Lord. That is, he assumes that unity is possible even when there is diversity of perspective, diversity of opinion, diversity of conviction on certain matters, that is possible. And I think sometimes we assume that if you and I disagree, well, then we can't be in fellowship with one another. Mm. Or that on Sunday morning when we gather for worship, I agree with all these people on everything, and I simply don't. The fact of the matter is we disagree, and sometimes on some important matters. But what Paul is telling us in John 17 is telling us, it's possible to be to have unity, but with diversity and potentially also diversity of perspective and opinion.
Mm. So how would you unpack the prayer of Jesus? Why, you know, maybe we could just, speculate is probably not the right word, but I'm just thinking of all the many things that Jesus could be praying for. He did really spend a long time praying about that. Maybe I can start us off. My suspicion has got to do with the Shema, you know. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. There's something about the oneness of God that is very powerful, and that we are incorporated into the life of God, you know, when we are born again, and there is that oneness. So could it be also that we are missing on some a really deep spiritual reality when we are looking at the behavioral unity, and when the behavioral unity falls short of that, we kind of like, you know, oh well, then that's not real, you know. It's like a married couple. They have fights and they disagree, but it doesn't take away the fact that they said their vows and before God they are one, you know. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, that our marriages in Canada do not have fights and disagreements. Just I want to be very clear. I want to be very clear about that. I don't know what's going on in Singapore, but no. Yeah, really, no, sure, Joella, yeah. My wife and I, we have a deeply dynamic, life-giving, generative relationship, friendship. But do we differ? You bet we do. Mm-hmm. And I've married a feisty woman who's opinionated, who's smart, and who often sees things differently than I do. But that doesn't break our relationship. And for me, that's the key, is do our disagreements actually sever the relationship so we are no longer able to be, and now back to the context of the church, able to be in fellowship with one another. And I think what we have started to tolerate is this idea that I cannot be in fellowship with you unless you and I agree with one another. And I want to suggest that, no, it is possible to have diversity of perspective and still be in fellowship and worship together, be at peace with one another.
Mm. Which means what we need to drill down is this idea of fellowship. Maybe we have a misunderstanding of what it means to have fellowship, to have that union with God and to be united to God and therefore enjoy unity. It is, we need to unpack what that fellowship is, because we are understanding it wrongly. That's why we are putting unfair expectations of it. And that's why we have this mismatch with our experience. And you know, it's a problem, right?
I think that's very well stated. We do need to agree on certain things,
yes,
in order to be in fellowship.
Like what to eat, but, where to go for dinner.
Yeah. Well, and we can defer to one another. But at the same time, I think within the church, we can agree on certain convictions that are going to shape and inform our common life. But I often think that list has gotten too long. And we don't know how to disagree. We don't know how to distinguish between those things that are fundamental and non-negotiable and those things about which we can respectfully disagree.
Mm. Yeah. And I also suspect that with the rise of maybe the non-denominational churches, some of that rich tradition of how churches have actually maintained fellowship and oneness despite having doctrinal, denominational distinctives, it might be lost to a younger generation that is not schooled in that as well.
That's a very interesting observation. I'm grateful to be part of a denomination here in Canada called the Christian and Missionary Alliance. And I don't think it exists in Singapore. But
we
think of ourselves,
you guys, in the past.
Okay.
Yeah, CME, yes.
But we think of the denomination. I think of the denomination as, I use the phrase big tent. Mm. That is, we're big tent, meaning we don't have such a rigidly defined identity that only people who look like and feel like and talk like me can be part of this denomination. And I think what happens sometimes in standalone, independent, or non-denominational churches is that often they circulate around a particular conviction or belief or perspective or person who articulates that. And unless you agree with that pastor or that leader, well, then you're not welcome here. And so it creates the sense of its unity around a particular doctrine or perspective or person that, in my mind, is not the unity that Jesus is speaking about in John 17.
Right. I think closely related to this, you know, this need to understand our tradition, our history, the wealth of how we have managed this, as well as the depth of the meaning of fellowship and unity, is also the need to differentiate between disagreement and difference with conflict. Just because I disagree with you does not mean our relationship, as you say, does not mean we have to break fellowship, does not mean that our relationship has to be conflictual. Could you speak into that?
Jenny, I think you sent me in advance some of the questions you might be raising, and I saw that right away. Mm. It just jumped right out at me when you said differentiate between disagreement and conflict. And I said, yes. That is precisely what I think people often forget. They assume if we disagree, we are in conflict. Mm. No, we're not. We just disagree. And you're wrong. I'm sorry about that, but we disagree. No, of course I think you're wrong and you think I'm wrong. We can actually have a vigorous debate. And then once we've had that debate, seeing things from a different side, respectfully and honorably disagreeing with the other, then we can go for dinner together. And I wonder often, you know, if people, it depends maybe the home that you grew up in.
Yeah.
So my family, my parents, they encouraged us at the dinner table to debate vigorously, everything from politics to doctrine to sports to who was the best soccer player in the world. And we would disagree. But then afterwards, we're still family. Mm. But there was a safety, and I think we found a safety as children to disagree and to debate because we knew our parents kind of held it all together. But it wasn't a nice cozy dinner. It was a dinner characterized by vigorous debate and learning. And I hope I added the word learning intentionally. I hope that we can disagree in a way that I need to remain open to what new learning can come to me from the person who sees things differently from myself.
Yeah, that's a very important point, right? I think a lot of it has got to do with our cultural background, our family background, how we were raised. And especially over here in Asia, we are really generally quite conflict avoidance. So we do tend to disagree a lot. And I've also heard of Christian homes where parents feel like, you know, if they disagree, they have to do it behind closed doors. And, you know, in the end, there is no one to model for the children what it looks like and what it feels like to live through the heartache, as it were, of disagreement. But realize that that is not the whole story. And yeah, and if you don't see in church as well, you know, the leaders are banging tables behind closed doors, and then they come in front and they all stand in front and say that they all agree on the same thing. And nobody is taken to this exercise of what if we disagree? How do we do this? You know? We are the poorer for it.
Yeah. And we assume that if we are unanimous, it means God is with us.
As if God can't see what happened in the meeting.
Right. So we want to say, well, it's unanimous. Oh, well, then must be God was in it. Mm. But I think we need illustrations. We know that within the New Testament, that Peter and Paul had some significant disagreements. Right. We can read in Acts chapter 15 that the early church had some significant disagreements. And we can learn for how they managed them and how they approached them. And I keep referring to Romans 14. Where Paul did not resolve the differences, but urged them to remain still in fellowship with each other, despite those differences of opinion. Mm. So we can see examples of it in scripture, but I do think you stated it well, that both within the church and within homes, children seeing their parents disagree will feel uneasy. They will feel threatened. They will feel insecure unless they know that a disagreement is not going to threaten the relationship.
Yeah.
And similarly, I think within the church, people can know that the elders disagreed. There was a diversity of opinion, but when all was said and done, this is how they've agreed to go forward. Mm. And those that disagreed have deferred to the majority or whatever it happens to be, but they've been able to express their opinion and haven't been forced to comply because it's a false unity.
Mm.
It's a pseudo unity. It's not really the unity that is built around the diversity that I'm speaking about.
Yes.
And so in the British parliamentary system, there's this strange expression, the loyal opposition.
Right.
And I think some people think, well, if you're in opposition, then you're not loyal. Mm. And if you're loyal, you're not in opposition. But no, I can differ with you, but still defer to you. You're the prime minister. But I'm going to at least let you know my opinion, not because I'm trying to undermine you, but because I'm trying to think you need to hear the other side or you need to hear another perspective. But in the end, you are the prime minister and you'll make the call. And the same thing can happen I think at Ambrose University, the faculty know that the vice presidents don't always agree, but they do know that that the president's willing to hear diversity of opinion. Mm. But in the end, I'm going to make the call, but not because I think my vice presidents aren't smart. I'm just making the call and this is what I've decided to do, but I respectfully and I ask that vice presidents respectfully disagree, but then in the end, let me as the president provide the leadership that I need to provide.
Right. So the next question is, what is the cost that the church is paying when we are unable to navigate difference?
What an interesting
conflict. What is it costing us?
Well, there's always conflict. There's always disagreement. And when it's suppressed, when it doesn't come out, it often comes out in unhealthy ways.
Yeah,
it comes out in anger of young people who are just who just blow up and or because they don't know how to express it in a way that is constructive. So they don't know how to express disagreement in constructive ways.
Yeah,
I think also we lose out on wisdom because I think when, for example, within the faculty at Ambrose University, when we're debating something, I hear the minority view and I realize, oh, make a note of that. Mm. Even though I disagree with them, they're reminding me of something that needs to be remembered when all of this is said and done.
Right.
That is, it's not just black and white, right and wrong.
Mm.
I think I'm right, but I need to hear. So even when I disagree with Joella, I need to hear her. And often first of all, she might persuade me. I need to be open to changing my mind. And when we don't allow for disagreement, then there's no possibility that of new learning, of changing my mind.
Mm.
Or that, yes, Joella, now that I think about it, I see I don't agree with you, but you've actually reminded me of something that is very important. And so we see that in Acts 15, there was a minority opinion, but James, the head of the church in Jerusalem, was wanting to acknowledge that minority opinion and the perspective that it brought to the discussion. It made for a better decision. It made for greater wisdom. It made for greater learning because there was diversity of opinion.
Yeah. Those are such great examples. And you mentioned that it costs us sometimes the next generation. And it's true because we do have a generational tension, especially with how rapidly society is changing and how the young people are seeing things. And I want to bring up one point relating to that and also the cost to us of actually gaining wisdom as we learn to manage our disagreements and even our conflict and the many opportunities of new learning that we miss because we are not taking time to listen to one another, to slow the process down and not to insist on maybe a seniority or majority decision, whatever is happening at that moment.
Well said.
So, you know, with the younger set, there is sometimes maybe just a lot of soul weariness from watching the conflict. We know that we have a younger generation. Many of them have grown up in dysfunctional, broken homes, very trying circumstances. And they go to church and they see all these things happening and they see all this stuff happening in the world. They are world weary. And I've heard this popular saying where they say, you know, it's more important to be loving than to be right. What would you say to a young person who's saying that to you? It's more important to be loving than to be right.
Well, I think then the way in which the New Testament speaks about love, it speaks about the love as intertwined with truth.
Yeah.
So Paul speaks about speaking the truth in love. And I think oftentimes we think being loving is being nice and being cordial and civil, but there's no place for genuine, thoughtful engagement, the one with the other, that brings forth a deepening of truth and a deepening of understanding and a deepening of learning. So I want to call instead for speaking the truth in love and then thinking about conversation, grace-filled conversation. That is dynamic, not conflictual, but dynamic, that is vigorous, that is frank. We can speak to one another frankly, but not rude, not uncivil, that there's a deep mutual respect for one another in that process that I think needs to inform that. So I think, I wonder if that's almost a false polarity between truth and love, because the only gospel we know is the gospel of love that is founded on the truth.
Yeah.
So I don't love you unless I'm prepared to speak the truth to you. I don't love my neighbor unless I'm not willing, unless I'm able to speak truth to my sister or my brother.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when I meet young people who say that, I also like to challenge them about whether that is truly the loving thing to do, because it feels safer to just sidestep the issue and not disagree. But is that truly loving? Both for the other person and even for yourself, because you are not growing yourself either. Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm not, I don't need to, I mean, I have, in my world, there's some people that every time they see something wrong, they need to say it.
Every time
they disagree, they need to say it. And it's just exhausting. And
I don't think that's what we're talking about, but it's true.
It isn't. And I think it's important though to say, you don't have to speak to everything. In fact, many times at the beginning of my day, I pray, Lord, do I need to speak to this or can I just let it go? Is this something where I need to speak to a performance issue with a vice president? Do I need to bring this to their attention or should I just let it be? And I don't need to speak to everything, but I need to have discernment to know what is constructive, what is edifying, but I don't want a cheap unity or a cheap love, a cheap grace.
Excellent. I'm going to shift gear now and we want to, you know, distill some wisdom from you because of all the many books you've written. But one that I'm familiar with a few of your books. And I remember reading Listening to the Voice of God in Times of Decision.
Way back.
But the particular book I want to bring up is this one you wrote about three mainstreams in the church historically, the evangelical, the sacramental, and the Pentecostal. And you argue in your book that the church should be all three, you know. So I thought our listeners would be very curious to know how that's even possible. So what's the main thesis of your book, and how do you propose we do that? How do you propose the evangelicals, the sacramental, which will be maybe the High Anglican, maybe even the Catholics, the Orthodox, and the Pentecostal, of course, the Charismatics, the Pentecostal Church, Assemblies of God. How do you propose that we all come together and, you know, experience that oneness? Yeah, tell us a little bit more about this hope of reconciliation that this book is speaking of.
Sure. Well, first of all, to say right there in Singapore, you have all three. So you've got the Evangelical Presbyterians, and you've got the Assemblies of God, and you've got and you've got probably the Anglo-Catholics or the High Anglicans, those that are more sacramental in their disposition, those that are more word-oriented, text-oriented, yes, and those that are more the immediate presence of the Spirit-oriented. I think what I have come to see, I'll say, well, two or three things. One, there's no doubt that in my growing up, that these were viewed as inherently in opposition to one another. Mm-hmm. So I remember hearing somebody said, I'm evangelical. That means I'm not right. sacramental. I'm not Pentecostal. These were polarized against one another. Mm. And so I grew up in Ecuador. Our pastor was very anti-sacramental and anti-Pentecostal. Mm. And all worship for him was, we open the Bible, we read the Bible. That's all there is to do. That's worship. And we read and we preach the scriptures, and we are actually anti-sacramental, anti-charismatic. And I think that's the context, and it seems like that's a false polarity. Mm. Could it be that in actual fact, the witness of the scriptures testifies to both and? Yeah. So we read, for example, that the early church devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the Lord's table. Oh, you know, and I think, oh, look at that. They devoted themselves to both. Why are these being polarized? And I know how they got polarized, because I know the history of the church.
Yeah.
And there's these overreactions. So the one church becomes overly sacramental, read Catholic, and then the evangelical Protestants become anti-sacramental. And so we overreact to an error. And I think there was a legitimate error, but we overreact and we create, ironically, another error. And so for me, part of the learning has been to say, are these unnecessarily polarized, the one against the other?
Right.
Secondly, I think there's no doubt a reflection here of my own journey. I'm deeply evangelical in my sensibilities, a deep love of the text, a deep conviction of the importance of preaching. But then along the way, came to a greater sense of the immediacy of the Spirit in my life. And rather than being anti-Pentecostal charismatic, I didn't convert to the Assemblies or whatever, but I came to a greater appreciation, even the book you mentioned, Listening to God in Times of Choice, of the immediacy of the Spirit in my life.
Yeah.
And rather than polarizing text and Spirit, realized that why can't I read the text in the fullness of the Spirit?
Mm.
And then, without doubt, as significant on this journey as any, is a growing appreciation of the weight and the significance of the Lord's table and of baptism. Deeply moved. I have been deeply moved by the text of Luke 24, when the two on the road to Emmaus recognized Jesus in the breaking of the bread. And it was just this realization of Christ is present to me in this event, in this bread cup, in this sacrament.
Mm.
Not that he's not present in the word, but it's both and.
Yeah.
And so for me, it has been very gratifying to write this book and find that many people have been saying, oh, thank you, because I've always wondered, why are we polarizing these, and why can we not be people whose worship is Spirit animated and generated, whose engagement with the scriptures is deeply thoughtful and exegetical, and then we move together to the holy table, and Christ is present to us in song, in word, and at the table, and that the three actually reinforce one another.
That's right.
And going back to our earlier conversation, I wonder, in a secular age, we can't afford to polarize these.
Mm.
I need to walk in the Spirit. I need to be attentive to the word. I need to meet with my fellow believers at the table. Why polarize these? Mm. All of this is God's grace to me, especially in an increasingly secular age.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
also some are going to emphasize more than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sometimes with Anglo-Catholics and I want to roll my eyes and think, my goodness, or you call that a sermon, you know, and I think, you know, but I don't want to dispense with them. I want to learn from them and with them. Mm-hmm. And they have something to teach me about this journey.
Absolutely. And I think many of us who have been on the journey with Christ for some length of time, we feel and experience this expansion of our soul to embrace something.
Good phrase.
Beyond,
good phrase. Expansion of my soul. Yes, I love it.
To embrace something beyond what we are used to, what we grew up with.
Yes.
And I think that's a very common experience. Although I'm not sure it's as easy where you are in your large country, but in Singapore, we're so small, you see. If we are curious about the church down the road, we can literally just go down the road. in fact, in Singapore, we talk about having a very eclectic Christianity, kind of a buffet spread. There's a very downside to that in terms of maybe not sticking around long enough to go deep.
I hear you. There is a downside to that.
Mm.
So can we leverage the positives where we're learning from one another and challenging one another, but still remain faithful within our traditions? I hear you on the downside.
That's right.
I like
so
that.
I think we should encourage people to be rooted. But
yes.
Hey, go ahead and spread your branches as far out and catch as much sun as you can. Why limit yourself, right?
Well said.
Yeah. So what are the wider applications of developing this stance? You know, if every individual Christian, every pastor is willing to say, you know, I want you to be rooted in this congregation, but you know, God's kingdom is huge. It's this vast tree. The birds come nest in it. You know, go ahead and explore. What are some wider implications of that moving forward?
Well, we use the phrase, it's not unique to me, it's been growing, is the phrase receptive ecumenism.
Mm.
And the phrase is to say, when you and I across denominational lines differ, rather than viewing that as a source of opposition to one another.
Mm.
How can I be receptive to how God has been present to you in ways that you now are a means of grace to me?
Mm.
So my spiritual director is Roman Catholic. We disagree on quite a number of things, but he has been such a source of grace and strength and encouragement to me. Why is that a problem? But I know I have people in my world. What? Your spiritual director is Catholic? How can that be? And I just say, I'm deeply enriched. And he's not asking me to become a Catholic.
Mm.
He's willing to give himself as a friend and as a mentor, but I don't need to convert in order to receive that grace from the other.
Mm.
And Joella, my wife and I, we go to Evensong at the Anglican Cathedral here in Calgary. Well, our own church can't deliver Evensong, but hey, the Anglicans know how to do this.
Yes.
And so I go down for Evensong and I'm deeply enriched by it.
Mm.
And I meet with the dean of the cathedral. He's become a friend. He's not asking me to convert to Anglicanism. He's delighted that this evangelical coming out of my heritage and tradition will find grace, strength, and renewal in his context. And that he can that can be a gift to us. That is, and I could name more. For me right now at this stage, I'm deeply evangelical. This is my home. This is my heritage. This is where I'm anchored, but I'm deeply grateful for in what is the most challenging season of my life professionally, that I have a Catholic spiritual director and I have an Anglican cathedral in town that does Evensong as well as you're going to find anywhere in the world. And I'm graced and I'm enriched and I'm encouraged by that.
Mm.
And that is a gift to me that is coming to me from other Christians and traditions. And 2 years ago, I spoke at a conference of evangelicals and Orthodox theologians in Boston, in the United States.
Oh, that
was a stretch for me. I was the first. And I gave a presentation and they gave a response. Then they gave presentations and I had to give a response.
Mm.
And you're on your toes. How can I learn? What are they saying? What do their questions mean? And I found the whole thing. And then we went to eat together. And that's important. You have to eat together. And they had great food. But we laughed at the points of disagreement. But rather than viewing it as adversarial or as a battle, I'm going to try to persuade you.
Mm.
We wanted to create a greater understanding. Why is it so important? We would ask one another that. Mm. Huh. I don't think I agreed with it, but I thought, oh, I can see why that matters to you, right, as a way to not just build bridges, but perhaps bring new learning to me. And again, I wasn't trying to convert them, and they weren't trying to convert me, but we were trying to build greater understanding through shared learning.
Wow. I'm sure that was a delightful sight to the Lord. Just watching.
Well, and
children,
also I should, you know, say this, in the book Wisdom from Babylon, I have a whole chapter on why the ecumenical movement is so important now. We cannot take on secularity alone.
Yeah.
So as the churches here in Calgary, we need to be in partnership with one another, encouraging one another, and in advocacy for one another, with one another, for the things that matter to us. Mm. I don't think we can do it alone. So we need to be ecumenism. It is an essential dimension of what it means to live in a secular society.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It leads very well to our final question to wrap this conversation up. You know, you can peer right across into your neighbor's backyard, your very famous neighbors. And I was just wondering, could you just share with us some instructive lessons for us as Christians as we witness what is going on in America? Just the amount of struggle, the degree of polarization in the church that's impacting the families. You know, we are reading of families not being able to go to church together anymore because of differences over politics, over vaccination, and all sorts of things, and large groups of people leaving an entire denomination. Like just very recently, a large group just left the Southern Baptist Convention. So America is just going through a lot of upheaval as we observe it. Share with us some things we can, well, of course, we want to pray for them because we love them, but also some things that are very important for us to take away as we watch what is going on.
Well, and let me just add, I value very much. I have often been on a plane between Singapore and Hong Kong, or Hong Kong and Singapore, these two twin cities, sister cities, and our sisters and brothers in Hong Kong are also going through a deep polarization between older and younger, especially, but it's not just generational in which they're, and it's with, like you say, it's within families. I think on the one hand, we need to lament what has happened. Jenny, I need to tell you, I really appreciate the way you framed the question was not judgmental, but one of coming alongside prayerfully to lament the deep polarization, the deep way in which religious identity has been blended with a political ideology. And for me, that is the, whenever that happens, you're in a very dangerous state where you merge a political perspective or ideology with the religious faith, suddenly you've got a problem. And that's part of what's happened south of the border, and not just in the United States, to some degree in Canada as well. But so we jokingly say we want to build a wall and we're going to make them pay for it. My best friends are in the United States. I spent Sunday afternoon on a 2-hour Zoom call with good friends that we were colleagues together when we were working in the Philippines. So on the one hand, I think, and that's been blended with a cult of personality that I think is also deeply, deeply troubling. Mm. So when you blend ideology, a political persuasion, and a cult of personality, inevitably it creates that problem. And until some of those sincere Christian believers recognize that they have politicized their own faith, and they have put themselves in bed with a personality that does not reflect their faith, until that happens, it's very hard to come to some resolution. But secondly, the other part that I think is a lesson learned is the unwillingness to tolerate diversity. And it's not just within the church. So the very best policy that's established, say, within the U.S. Senate requires a bipartisan working together across political divides. And and when the United States has been at its best, you get a Democrat senator and a Republican senator working together, disagreeing, but coming together to say, what can we agree on for the good of the nation? Right. But what's happened is we actually have Republicans who would want their president to fail. I mean, that's just bizarre. Mm. You don't want your president to fail. You want your president to succeed, because only then does your country flourish. But you've created this kind of polarization where you actually want your opponent to fail. And that is something that I think we stopped then. What's happened, and you've mentioned, you know, I'm in dialogue with people in Texas right now who curse their president rather than pray for their president.
Oh, dear.
And that really is also, I think, deeply troubling and problematic. So we've lost the capacity, and I'll end with this. We've lost the capacity for conversation. And it goes back to our very opening comments that what we need to sustain in the midst of disagreement, conflict, diversity of perspective is the grace of being able to still talk to one another. And when we pray for our sisters and brothers in both Hong Kong and in the U.S., United States, I think as much as anything, we need to pray that they don't lose the capacity to be in conversation with one another and to lower the temperature so that that conversation can continue.
Right. Thank you so much. I really love that phrase, capacity for conversation. And I think it's good to end with some reflections about that. Why have we lost that capacity? What has caused us to become so fraught that we are unable to listen to one another? What has happened? Has there been so much hurt that we have not lamented and have not brought to the Lord for healing that is actually built up? Have there been serious missteps where, like you say, we have aligned our spiritual convictions and religious beliefs with personality and politics and other positions? So those are missteps. And are we at a place, church and Christians, where we must go back to scripture and look at the truth that disagreements will happen, conflicts will happen, but God has precisely in the context, especially in the New Testament churches, none of them were perfect, given us clear imperatives, such as to speak the truth with love, to let your speech be seasoned with grace, to let love cover over a multitude of sins to bear with one another, and to forgive quickly. 70
and to forgive seven. Quickly. Oh, you said it all. I'll say one more thing. I don't need to repeat anything you said. Spot on, everything you just said. I'll say one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think fear undercuts the capacity for good conversation.
Yeah.
And so when we live, as Henry Nouwen put it, in a culture of fear, one of the symptoms of a culture of fear is we polarize against one another. And so we're afraid of one another and afraid of disagreement and afraid that somehow you are going to hurt me or not going to be looking out for my best. So there's no doubt that much of what we see is fear. And fear, I think, is the soil in which all the things you described that need to be happening, speaking the truth in love, forgiving one another quickly, not carrying resentments, being able to learn from one another and learn with one another, all of that gets undermined when we live in a perpetual fear.
Yeah, and I think the church of all people should be able to stand up and look fear in the eye and say, hey, I've got the love of God and His perfect love can cast out this fear.
But
and
Jenny,
not contribute to that cesspool.
Students.
It's a cesspool of fear that we are living in the world right now. With
FOMO, powerful word.
Social media, and we are all getting our water from that cesspool and poisoning ourselves.
Ouch.
So I think it's really, really important.
I'm
going
to quote you on the cesspool. Whoa,
as Christians
what an image.
And as a church, to wake up to the reality, to what we are perpetuating, but and at the same time, really lay hold of our call to be salt and light and say, no, I mean, this is not the way. This is not our way. This is not Christ's way.
So and the pandemic has reinforced it too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we gather for worship, one of the most important things that needs to happen is the anxiety level goes down and the trust level in Christ goes up. Every Sunday, through our hymns, through our preaching, through our greeting one another, there's a growth in faith and the anxiety level goes down. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge. And part of leadership, part of the role of the Cathedral podcast, part of leadership within a university is to lower the anxiety level, to say it again. We can speak, you and I can speak to one another with a deep confidence that Christ sits on the throne. We do not need to live with anxiety and fear and fretfulness, but we can live in the peace that transcends all understanding.
Amen. Thank you so much, God, for this conversation.
You're very
the
welcome.
The peace of Christ be with you.
And with you.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.